What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to episode 97 of Star Wars Beneath Twin Suns, a massive breakdown podcast. We're coming to you on a fantastic Sunday morning. Very excited to talk about the next two episodes and our chronological Clone Wars watch through. We have Jedi Crash and Defenders of the Peace. And I don't know if you guys remember from last week's episode, but I was not, you know, super excited about these episodes. I didn't really remember. I remembered the general gist of what happened. Didn't really remember a ton about them. But I got to say, I watched through them and I was actually pretty impressed with the episodes. I wouldn't say they were masterpieces or anything, but I definitely came away a lot more optimistic about them than I thought I would be prior to rewatching them. So let's talk about those. But first, let's get the introductions out of the way. As always, I'm your host, Mercules, joined today by Kit Kutcha. And how are you doing today, Kit?
Well, Mercules, I am doing pretty fantastic, as usual. Had a great time sitting down with my daughter to watch these episodes. And yeah, I have to say, I felt like in my memory of these, they had really kind of diminished in quality. And I think maybe that's just sort of a natural thing that happens as you watch the later seasons, which are a lot, you know, a lot stronger. These episodes don't necessarily stand up in comparison to some of what we get in the later seasons of the Clone Wars. But, you know, I do have to say, as far as just for what they were for season one episodes, they were fun to watch. You know, I thought they did some interesting things, and I appreciate the tack that they're taking here in terms of kind of introducing or sort of, you know, working on kind of reinforcing and building up the themes of the series in terms of questioning who's in the right and what is the, you know, what is the correct response? You know, how should the Jedi be responding? How should you feel about the Clone Wars? And, you know, these are kind of questions that are being asked, and they don't really have a specific answer in this episode, although they do tell you how various people might answer those questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I liked about this is the same thing. We've actually had this happen a number of times so far in season one, which I didn't remember prior to rewatching this, but I now see that it was probably an intentional design choice. But they're introducing us to a lot of these Jedi masters, different ones, other than Anakin and Obi-Wan, you know, getting Kit Fisto, Aayla Secura, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Plo Koon, right? Like these characters that were like background characters in the Star Wars prequel movies are now the focal point of a couple of arcs, and that's leading to a different, you know, a different kind of familiarity with them, which I really like. In particular, I really actually liked Aayla Secura. I thought she was a great character in this. This is actually like it's her second appearance or whatever, because technically she was in, you know, the movies. But this is her first time like really having a full speaking role. And Aayla Secura's backstory is kind of interesting. She was originally from a Dark Horse comic book. And George Lucas liked the character design so much, he just like co-opted that and just like brought her straight into the movies. He was like, oh, that's a cool character. I like that. I like that Twilight Jedi. Let's bring him in. So that's where she came from. I really like that these episodes, not all the episodes in season one, but these two episodes in particular, both of them have like a moral, right? And obviously every Clone Wars episode kind of has a moral. It usually associates with whatever the fortune cookie is that they tell us in the beginning. But these two in particular, like kind of hammered on it a little bit harder. The moral in the first episode is, of course, like you can't let attachment blind you to doing what is right, you know, talking about Ahsoka and Anakin. And the moral in the second episode was that, like, you can try to avoid violence if you want, but at some point in time, you're going to have to choose. And choosing to forego violence may lead to your own destruction, right? And I don't know that was like specifically a parallel to what has happened in real life before, but that is something that happened in, you know, in World War II prior to the outbreak of a fully armed conflict. But a lot of countries and peoples kind of were like, well, you know, we'd prefer not to be involved in this, right? Like we'd prefer to not fight. We'd prefer to not go to war. And that was obviously the strategy of appeasement that was done by, you know, the UK prior to Winston Churchill becoming the prime minister. And obviously that didn't end up working out. What that ended up leading to is that the aggressors who were okay with violence were able to steamroll over places that were kind of like trying to take the high road and stuff. So I did appreciate that parallel. The morals that they give in these season one episodes, they aren't quite as emotionally charged, I think, as the morals that they give in the later, like season five, six, and seven episodes. And I think that's probably why I had like forgotten about them a little bit. But rewatching them kind of in isolation, they're still there. And I kind of like that. I think that's what makes a good Clone War episode is there's, you know, there's a message behind it, a positive message, something for not necessarily just children, but something anyone who's watching the episode can maybe learn a little bit from.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think certainly like one of the other things I kind of appreciate about these episodes is that we do get, I think, a good insight into Anakin's moral ethics, specifically with regards to how he deals with the Lerman and the Separatists and sort of the inevitable conflict that develops over the course of the story arc and the way that he imparts those decisions to Ahsoka, who is sort of struggling, I think, with the situation. She doesn't understand why the Lerman won't stand up for themselves. And then, you know, she sort of questions, like, you know, if Anakin is being consistent in his moral decision-making, you know, where he first, you know, is sort of like, that's fine, you know, do what you want. And then he ends up saying, well, no, we're going to defend you anyways. And we can maybe, we can talk about that a little bit more during the episode, but, you know, he kind of draws a line. And he says it actually explicitly in the second episode. There's a difference between, you know, not dragging bystanders into a conflict and leaving them to die. You know, and so I really appreciate, I think, sort of that insight into the character of Anakin Skywalker, because I think it is a huge part of the story of the Clone Wars is Anakin's moral journey and the experiences that shape his view of the galaxy and his view of right and wrong, and sort of, I think, in many ways, his view of what his responsibility is. And that's something that's a theme I kind of want to come back to over the series, I think, because, you know, obviously by the end of it, he's like, I will bring peace, you know, stability, security to my new empire. And he at that point, you know, we sort of see him at this place where he's just like, nobody else can be trusted to do this right, so I will make the decisions for everyone. Mm-hmm. I know what's best for everyone. No one else is competent. And, you know, early on, you know, I think we see him in a very different place, where he's still trying to see the best in people. And that journey is such a key part of the story of Star Wars, right? So I really appreciate that we kind of get direct quotes from Anakin on his moral viewpoint here, because we're going to see it change. And yeah, that's all. I just want to call that out, because I think you could really easily miss that in this episode, which is about these funky lemur type aliens who roll around, and, you know, there are kind of some sort of comedic elements to the episode, and I don't know, you know, I like to call out those moral themes in the series when we see them.
Mm-hmm. See, and alternative to that, you're looking at Anakin. I was looking a lot at Ahsoka during this, because there is a distinction that George Lucas has made and Filoni carries on with between love and attachment, right? And they have been very explicit multiple times that attachment is something that must be avoided, but love is something that must be encouraged, right? And the difficulty that the Jedi and these characters face is separating those two things, right? And Ahsoka in particular is having difficulty separating in this episode. We know for a fact that Anakin cannot separate the two, right? And Anakin and Ahsoka in their later years kind of take two different tacks to it. Anakin can't separate love and attachment. So he goes, you know, he goes all the way in. And our, you know, fortune cookie kind of that we have at the beginning of Jedi Crash. So the fortune cookie ended up being greed and fear of loss are the roots that lead to the tree of evil. Right. Obviously, fear of loss is part of attachment. And that's what led Anakin to fall. The original version of this They changed the fortune cookie was for one to not become attached is the greatest gift, right? So love without attachment is what they're kind of looking for here. And Ayla Secura embodies that quite well. And she explains it in the episode that her master was like a father to her, but in the end, she had to learn to let him go, mm-hmm. right? And that's something that you have to do in real life with your parents as they age, and the possibility, you know, their mortality becomes more real than it is to you maybe as a child. That's something you have to do with everyone at some point, right? Like, to live is to be mortal. It means you will at some point in time lose. And fear of that loss is what drives people down the path of the dark side. She tries to explain that, which, by the way, Ayla Secura's master, this is not called out in the episode, but it's Keenlyn Voss is who her master was, interestingly. So we haven't seen him yet in Clone Wars, but we will see him, I think, in season two. He doesn't show up a ton, and he's also the main character in Dark Disciple, which is the Asajj Ventress, Keenlyn Voss, Count Dooku novel that was supposed to be an 8-episode Clone Wars arc that didn't end up getting made. But I did think that was interesting when I was reading back on it, because I was like, oh, she doesn't mention who her master is. I wonder who that is. It's Keenlyn Voss, which is pretty cool. And he's obviously one of the Jedi who's in the same vein as Qui-Gon Jinn, where he's like borderline bucking the Jedi Order. He's kind of off doing his own thing. He's a little bit of a rebel. He doesn't really agree with them, right? But that's, you know, that's not for this episode. But so I like the call out there of the trying to separate love from attachment, trying to separate care from attachment. Ahsoka calls it out. We see that as Ahsoka grows, she starts to get a better handle on this. But when she leaves the Jedi Order, she kind of loses her way. And in the Ahsoka TV series, we see that she has swung the other way, where instead of trying to separate love and attachment, she just cuts herself off from all of it, right? She does the exact opposite thing that Anakin did, where he gives himself all the way into it. She cuts herself off from everything. And as we learn by the end of the Ahsoka series, like the true path is the one in the middle of those, right? Where you love, but you're not afraid of loss. And so this, I thought, planted the seeds very, very early that was going to be, you know, a potential conflict for all characters in the Jedi Order, but specifically for our main characters. And so I like that they addressed it early. And Ahsoka, it gets said to her, but she doesn't really come to terms with it right now. And it's interesting watching this, and she's obviously, she's a child in this, right? And then we come back and we see the Ahsoka series, which we just watched, and she's, you know, fully grown, and she's still struggling to, you know, to grapple with these terms, which I thought was pretty cool. So like, I like seeing that character development drawn out over, you know, 40 years of a character's life, basically, which I thought was interesting. So we can probably go ahead and hop right into Jedi Crash. I actually thought these episodes, like, they managed to cram a lot of story into a 2-episode arc. What it actually felt to me like, instead of it being like 2 21-minute episodes, it almost felt to me like it was like 4 10-minute episodes, right? Like, there's like pretty defined parts of each episode that are different. And the first part of Jedi Crash is obviously the battle, the atmospheric battle between Ayla Secura's forces and three separatist frigates led by a tactical droid commander. And Ayla Secura's forces are getting hammered pretty hard. And really their only hope at this point in time is for General Skywalker to get there quick enough to kind of rescue them.
Yeah. Yeah, so we open up as I kind of in the fashion that I really like when these episodes open up. They've kind of given us some backstory, given us some setup, and then we dive right into the action and we get some big, exciting visuals to kind of open the story up and, you know, get us invested, get us excited for what's going to happen next. So, you know, we've got this sort of ongoing battle, a losing battle being fought by Master Ayla Secura's ship. She's outnumbered. She's kind of been forced down into the atmosphere of the planet, which is actually, you know, so a fun trivia fact that we were talking about before, of course, is that this battle was originally scripted to take place in space. But then they moved it into the atmosphere of the planet because they thought that it would make, you know, for kind of like a more exciting visual, something a little bit different from a lot of what we've seen elsewhere. So I think they were right. You know, it is a very cool visual to see these ships kind of up in the upper atmosphere with all the clouds in the background. You know, we see the flames and we can kind of, you know, imagine like, boy, this is a bad situation to be in, right? It's very clear that like things are about to go very, very badly for for Aayla Secura's ship here. The Separatist droid commander, which is just a tactical droid at this point, no kind of named figures here, dispatches rocket droids to go and attack the ship directly and like board it. And Aayla Secura sends out clone troopers to you know, kind of get onto the hull and fight back and kind of prevent them from boarding the ship or causing any more damage. And that's right about when Anakin and Ahsoka arrive. They pop into real space and kind of dive straight into the atmosphere and launch gunships, having to kind of battle some of the rocket super droids along their way. In a classic Anakin move, he just like straight up jumps out of the gunship into the atmosphere and lands on one of the rocket droids, which he then uses to essentially just skydive straight onto the damaged clone destroyer ship. And it's, I don't know, it's just like, this is exactly the kind of crap where everyone's just like, why would you do that? And Anakin's like, because I can. Again, more super fun visuals we get after this. You know, the Ahsoka and the troops kind of catch up when their gunship gets there. And then I think, does their gunship actually crash?
Yeah,
I think it crashes into the ship.
One of the rocket droids like lands on top of the ship and is going to kill the pilot. And the pilot manages to kind of get out and get into, you know, the belly of the ship, but it leads it, you know, there's no one flying it anymore. So it kind of just rockets downward. And fortunately for them, instead of slamming into the side of the hull, it actually hits a hole that had already been blown by the rocket droids. So it kind of like crashes halfway through it,
right,
and allows them to escape out, which is extremely lucky. But, you know, plot armor, Jedi armor, whatever you want to call it, it was very lucky for them. They kind of managed to like kill a bunch of the droids that have infiltrated the ship in an attempt to escape. They've got a cruiser that's kind of docking to evacuate them out of the ship and evacuate any survivors. But the tactical droid loses his patience and is like, you know what? Just destroy the ship. This is taking too long. Like, I don't even care that there's 100 droids still on it. Like, just blow up the ship. So the Separatist cruisers kind of concentrate fire on it. And on their way out, the ship starts to detonate and Anakin stays behind to kind of block the explosion, and a very Kanan-esque thing from Rebels. He stays behind to block the explosion so the others can escape. And he manages to block a substantial amount of it, but it pushes him backwards into a bulkhead and kind of grievously injures him. And Ahsoka manages to cut open the bulkhead and kind of drag him through it and get him into the ship. And the cruiser is able to detach before the Liberty, which is actually Secura's destroyer's name, is the Liberty, before the Liberty, you know, completely is destroyed. But the tactical droid dispatches a bunch of droid fighters, and the droid fighters manage to damage the cruiser. And while it's trying to dock with Yularen's, I guess the Resolute, which is Anakin's ship, which is Yularen's ship, right? When it's trying to dock with the Resolute, the damage engages the hyperdrive and they can't deactivate it in time. So they have to detach from the ship, and kind of the hyperdrive launches them just in a random direction, basically. Right. And they're not really sure where they're going. Now, this was a bit controversial at the time, still remains controversial, because this was technically a hyperdrive activation in atmosphere, which supposedly is not able to happen. My headcanon for this is that we know that the Resolute was in the upper atmosphere, because Secura's ship was entering the atmosphere and was below them, right? So we know that the Resolute was above the Liberty. So here's my headcanon for this. The Resolute is high enough up, and the planet Quell, which is what they're over, is a small enough planet that the cruiser's hyperdrive was able to break the gravitational pull of the planet and get away. It was high enough up in the atmosphere. The planet was small enough. That's my headcanon for how it happened.
So another thing to keep in mind with the whole hyperdrive gravity well situation is that it's actually been mentioned in a few different canon media sources that hyperdrives are equipped with safety devices that deactivate them in the presence of a gravity well. because flying through a gravity well with your hyperdrive on is generally considered a, all caps, very bad idea. If you've, you know, miscalculated your jump, for example, and you're entering a gravity well, it could mean that you're about to fly into, say, the heart of a sun, which would absolutely pull you out of hyperspace and then incinerate you. And, you know, or you could be flying into a black hole, or, you know, who knows what, right? Han Solo gave us the list, right? All kinds of things that can go wrong if you've miscalculated your hyperspace jump.
You could impact a planet, right? You fly straight into a planet.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think they're probably, you know, also bearing in mind, of course, that all Star Wars science is a bit hand wavy and wishy washy. And it sort of works the way that it needs to work for the plot to function. I think there probably are gravity wells that are actually strong enough to entirely prevent hyperspace travel. You know, black holes would be an example. Probably most stars would be an example. Maybe very large planets, especially closer to the heart of the planet. But I think, you know, we've also seen, of course, many, many examples in Star Wars media where people do make hyperspace jumps in atmosphere. And it's simply, you know, it's very often simply criticized as being like, hey, that's super dangerous.
Right.
You know, it's really not good to do that. Like, you shouldn't jump to hyperspace when there is a when you're in a gravity well, because it probably makes the calculations much more complicated, because gravity never pulls exactly evenly. And B, you know, you're trying to jump to light speed in atmosphere, so you're actually hitting air particles on your way out, which is probably bad for the ship. And I think there are a few occasions where we see people jumping to hyperspace in atmosphere, and it actually does damage the ship. So it's generally, you know, lots of reasons why it might be a bad idea, depending on how hard science that exact series wants to treat it and exactly what they're trying to achieve. That said, it's also very clearly not impossible in the atmosphere of a planet to jump to light speed. It happens a lot more, honestly, than it probably should. And the heroes basically always get away with it. I'd really like them to, like, kill somebody who jumps to light speed in a gravity well at some point, just to remind everyone, like, hey, here's why it's a bad idea. You know? Like, it doesn't have to be a main protagonist. It can be, you know, like a side character or somebody who's, like, making a desperate jump to light speed. And it,
even someone evil, even someone bad.
Right. It could be somebody bad. You know, there are a few different ways we could do it. But I think that rule does need to be reinforced with an actual example in the media at some point. Maybe, you know, Andor is the right place to do that, because it's a darker show to begin with. Mm-hmm. But anyways, it's clearly not impossible. And we, you know, what we have here is a situation where someone has, where a clone trooper gets shot and accidentally triggers the hyperdrive in his, you know, dying moment. So, like,
I believe he was knocked out, not dead.
Oh, they okay.
I mean, maybe, yeah, so. He might have been dead, but yeah, he was, like, knocked out by the blast of a droid. Yeah, a droid fighter hitting the side of the cockpit. But
also, you know, those safety mechanisms are probably on most of the time. But we are in an active war here, and I wouldn't be shocked if on a military ship, they turn off all of the safety mechanisms so that they can do what they need to do when they need to do it.
Right.
They probably just have them off by default, especially, you know, if this is, these are like Anakin's soldiers. I'm certain he turns off all of the safety mechanisms on all of his ships.
Right.
They only get in his way. This is why he crashes so much.
They prevent him from doing what he needs to do, which is crash the ship.
Yeah.
In various ways. So they do jump into hyperspace. Yularen is like, you know, plot every possible course along those coordinates. Like, we got to find them. The jump to hyperspace is obviously badly calculated because it was activated inadvertently, and they're headed directly towards a star. So they're unable to, like stop the hyperdrive the way you would like it to be stopped, you know, by telling it, hyperdrive, please stop. So instead, they decide that they're going to power off all the systems, which will knock them out of hyperspace. And then they're going to power the systems back on and try to avoid the star. They're barely able to do it because as soon as they power off the hyperdrive, of course, they lose artificial gravity. They lose control, navigation, everything like that. It throws them out of hyperspace. And the only way they're able to get the systems back on with the sheer amount of G-forces that are being applied to all the passengers is for Ayla to use the force to like flip the switch back up to turn the auxiliary stuff back on. And this is kind of the end of what I thought was like the first part, like the first arc, right? It was like the space battle part is now done, right? And that actually lasted a lot longer than I really thought it was going to last and had a lot more to it. It was kind of more fleshed out than I expected it to be. They do manage to get the power switch back on. They barely manage to swing around the star and circle it, but their speed basically makes the ship nearly uncontrollable, and it sends them crashing into the nearby planet of Meridun, I believe is what it is. Meridun, maybe. They crash land, and they don't have a ton of survivors. I think it's Commander Bly, Rex, Ahsoka, an unconscious Anakin, three random troopers, which are Cameron, Lucky, and Flesh, the worst name for a trooper ever, and then General Ayla Secura. And so I looked up these troopers to see if they were in anything else. Interestingly, Lucky is the name that Boba takes for himself when he pretends to be a clone trooper trainee later on in the Clone Wars series. He uses the name Lucky. Commander Bly is actually the commander who kills Ayla Secura in Revenge of the Sith, in that movie.
Oof.
He's the commander who's standing behind her, and he's the one who actually shoots her. So that's kind of tough because Commander Bly is pretty cool in this. He's extremely competent, very good at his job. But yeah, he's actually the one who pulls the trigger and kills Ayla Secura in Revenge of the Sith.
Brutal. This is the kind of thing where I'm just like, man, this is a dark, dark series.
Yep.
Like, underneath the hood, you know, everyone who's like, Star Wars should be darker. I'm like, I don't think that it needs to get darker. Yeah. You just need to pay a little more attention.
So they crash land. They set up kind of a lean-to to shelter Anakin. And Ayla correctly points out, like, hey, we've got to find help. Like, we need to find, you know, anyone who lives here. Bly has found, like, a carving on some tree bark that seems to indicate that there is some sort of intelligent life on this planet. And Ahsoka really badly wants to stay behind with Rex and Anakin. And Ayla's like, Ahsoka, that doesn't make sense. Like, you can't do anything for Anakin here. You need to come with us. And I think this is at the point in time where, you know, she kind of starts to explain to Ahsoka, like,
right,
it is not the Jedi way for you to be so attached that you throw away the opportunity to help simply to emotionally fulfill your need to, like, be with the person you care about who is hurt, right? Like, you can't do that. You need to think clearly. You need to think rationally. I think later in the episode, she says it, don't throw away 1,000 lives to save one. Right. And So she's not super thrilled about it, but she does agree to go with them. And so Rex stays behind to watch Anakin by himself. And Bly, the other three clone troopers, Ahsoka and Ayla, head off to try to find the locals. Because there was a giant tree depicted on the bark carving, they head in those directions. They find the giant trees. It turns out that the giant trees have giant seed pods, like giant pine cones that come rocketing down and nearly kill them. And Ahsoka's not pleased. She's like, you'd have to be crazy to live by one of these trees. These trees want to kill you. But they realize that the giant seed pods, once they fall, there are some marks in the ground that seem to imply that the seed pods have been dragged off. And so she kind of wisely is like, well, if we just follow the dragging trail, we'll probably find whoever's using them.
Right. Yeah, so I really appreciate sort of the way that this is set up, because we kind of get, you know, a little bit of sort of a like kind of a mini little mystery solving bit here, right? They found this clue, you know, this carving, and like, oh, you know, the locals must live near giant trees, right? Which is, I guess, a reasonable conclusion based on the picture that we're shown. And so then they go to the giant tree and they get there and like, oh, obviously people don't live close to these things. It'd be suicidal. But then they find another clue, right? And so I think that's just like, it's a really nice, clean structure. It's very simple. You almost don't even notice the way that it's set up, but it feels very satisfying. You find a clue, you make a conclusion, you go check it out. You're like, oh, my conclusion was wrong. But then you find another clue, and it kind of leads you on in the story. And so it's just like a really nice, simple, clean narrative structure.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate the writers for that.
Yeah, it's better for the Jedi to like go off in one direction that is generally the correct direction, but isn't quite right, and then bounce off of that to the correct direction, I think it makes it a little bit more relatable than like they just leave and instantly find exactly what they're looking
for. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. It makes it feel much more real life. If your path to the solution isn't quite as clean, you know, as sometimes it is, you know, as it is for Anakin, you know, where he's just like, yep, yeah. straight to the solution.
So back at the crashed ship, Anakin is still mostly unconscious. Rex hears something rustling in the bushes and he wants to go check it out. Anakin briefly comes to, he opens his eyes, he tries to get up, but obviously he's pretty badly hurt. I also appreciated how badly hurt they made Anakin for this episode. We obviously know he doesn't die, but they do a good job of putting him out of commission and realistically showing a way that Anakin could be hurt this badly, right? Like yeah. doing something to try to protect people he cares about hurts him grievously, which is realistic for him as a character. And it hurts him badly enough that it makes sense that he is mostly out of commission for this episode. And his recovery isn't just like a snap overnight. He's like, oh, back to normal, right? Like he slowly starts making progress. He goes from being fully unconscious to barely able to stand, to barely able to walk, to needing to be healed, right? Like he doesn't just like pop back from his injury and be perfectly fine. So I appreciated that. He does manage to, you know, to kind of squeak out like, Rex, it's behind you, which gives Rex just enough time to turn around and be hit by what's called a Mastiff Fallone, is I believe how this is pronounced. I don't think they actually call it that in the episode, but canonically that is what it's called. It actually shows up not just in this episode, but there's an episode later in the series called Wookiee Hunt where the Trandoshans have one of these beasts like in the hold of their mobile headquarters, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, it attacks Rex, and Rex barely manages to kind of scare it off by firing his blaster. But at the same time, two more of the animals attack the clones and Ayla, Ahsoka, and Bly, and unfortunately they kill all of the generically named clone troopers. So they don't manage to make it through, but the other three do. And they manage to find a village of a people called the Lerman, which I thought was very funny because it's basically just lemur, but with, you know, the letters moved around and an N thrown in there. And that's exactly what they look like. They're like Scottish lemurs. Like, is that what their accent was? It sounded Scottish to me, but it was kind of an interesting like mix of things that are familiar, but organized in such a way that it made it very unfamiliar.
Yeah, I guess I also heard that accent as Scottish. Hopefully nobody out there is going to be like, you're an idiot. But that's sort of how it came across to me. Or at least sort of Scottish-esque to our American ears. So it's actually there's kind of a lot going on here, you know, as they're exploring the planet and then getting to the Lerman, in terms of sort of references to previous unused material. So actually the whole design for these grasslands comes, I believe, from a Ralph McQuarrie painting that was originally used for another setting and then actually published in a book, I believe. Yeah, it was originally produced for Return of the Jedi, and it was, you know, for there was a, like another grassland planet named Sisamon, I think, and then it was later resurrected to depict the grasslands of Alderaan for the Illustrated Star Wars Universe, published in 1995 as like a coffee table book. And there were these sort of pod-like structures in the grasslands. In that book, I believe they were called Killick Mounds, which were supposed to be like these like termite-like hives from a supposedly vanished species. And so they were vaguely similar to what we get here in this kind of this finished version of the Clone Wars episodes. And then the Lerman were also a previous design. They had been like concepted for Revenge of the Sith and then discarded. And so they were used here on suggestion by George Lucas. He said, oh, hey, you should use these people for this planet. I think they'd be a good fit for the episode. Here we are.
Yeah, there's actually the Lerman are from Mygeeto. This is not their home planet. They colonized this planet.
Right.
This specific tribe colonized this planet in an attempt to avoid the war. There is actually a Jedi Lerman at one point in time. I think it was in the High Republic era. So that was done after this show, but I did think that that was kind of interesting. They're led by Tiwat Ka, who basically refuses to aid them. He's like, nope, we're pacifists. We're not doing this. If we aid you, then it's basically like taking a side. We can't do that because if we take a side with y'all, then it's going to bring the war to us. He's very dogmatic in his belief that they will not beget any violence in this community. But Ahsoka, you know, begs him. He's like, please, you know, my master is injured. He'll die without your help. We need you guys to help us. And he's like, well, as much as I can't, you know, shelter you or anything, like, all right, fine. We will send a healer to help your injured master. He was going to have to stay here as insurance. We don't want you to kidnap our healer or do anything to otherwise betray us. So Ayla stays behind. Bly and Ahsoka return to Anakin with Tiwat's son, Wagtu. And he helps them bring Anakin back to the village for medical support. There is a good conversation with Ayla Secura and the Elder, kind of talking about the war. And Ayla's like, you know, we didn't start the war. You realize that, right? Like, we're trying to bring peace to the galaxy. And he's like, it doesn't matter who started it. You guys are participating in it. Like, you are answering violence with violence. The only way for there to ever be peace is both sides have to basically lay down their arms. And that starts with one side doing it, right? And he's basically points out to her, like, you guys aren't laying down your arms. You're fighting. You're killing. You are causing this war to continue when you could choose not to. He's like, I don't see how you can call yourself a peacekeeper when you are, mm-hmm. you know, explicitly not keeping peace. And I appreciated that because as dogmatic as Tiwat is, and as incorrect as I think he is on the grand scheme of things, he does bring up an interesting point to Ayla, and Ayla doesn't really have a good response to it. And I think this highlights the issue that the Jedi Order has throughout the entirety of the Clone Wars, where they have pretty clearly become lost at some point in time.
Right. Yeah. You know, she refers to the Jedi as peacekeepers, and he just immediately is like, no, you're not peacekeepers. You know, you're war makers. And, you know, he says only when you lay down your arms and pursue a course of peace can you make this argument to me. And whether you agree with him or not, I think he raises, like you said, he raises a really important question. It's a question that is going to be asked again and again throughout this series, which is like, what is the correct course for the Jedi to take? And that's a question that the Jedi as an order and, you know, the Jedi Council are never able to fully answer. And that's part of why they lose, I think, is because they don't have a good answer for this kind of situation. They don't have a solution. And, you know, that's how they get lost. That's how they end up, you know, failing to uphold their ideals and sort of losing their connection with the Force and losing their power and being blinded by Sidious. Mm-hmm. Because they've become, you know, well, we don't need to go too far down that, but they've become so dogmatic and so, you know, kind of blinded by their own power that, you know, many of the criticisms, both of the Jedi and of the Republic, actually end up becoming true. So, you know, Tiwat Ka is somebody who has seen some of that, and he, you know, raises a great question. But in moving on here, we've got back at the lean-to, we've got Anakin sensing more creatures nearby, and, you know, over Rex's protestations, he kind of forces himself to his feet. He's like, you know, I have to fight. Which I think is kind of a fun juxtaposition with the conversation that we've literally moments ago just left, where Tiwat Ka is criticizing them for their willingness to fight. And then immediately afterwards, Anakin is saying, I have to fight. And, you know, I really appreciate the writers for the way that they're sort of lining things up in this episode in a way that is sort of like subtle, but also not. And, you know, so anyways, the two more of the Mastiff Falones leap out of the grass and attack them. Rex shoots one of them. The other one knocks them down. And luckily, the rescue party arrives sort of just in time to prevent any permanent injury. Rex, I think, actually, like, literally just gets, you know, like a death shake and then, like, thrown and somehow manages to roll out of it without serious injury. Kudos to Rex for being a badass.
Mm-hmm.
And Ahsoka is about to, like, you know, she pulls out her lightsaber. She's about to kill this thing. And Wag 2 is, like, more or less, like, begs her not to as he's trying to rope the creature down and topple it. He, like, manages to, like, lasso one of its feet. And they pull the creature down. And I assume, you know, leave it bound in some way that it will eventually escape back to the wild. They sort of don't cover that. But then they bring Anakin back to the village. And Wag 2 uses cloths soaked in a healing oil to treat Anakin's wounds. Just sort of a fun little, like, quirk of the series animation here, of course, is that you would think a healing oil would need to be applied directly to the skin, and Anakin is still in his full battle armor.
Yeah.
And he just sort of puts it on top.
You know, you just have to breathe it in. Breathing it in is what, what heals you.
Yeah, you know. Clearly, Wag 2 knows what he's doing, and I don't. So mm-hmm. We sort of can wave that off, but I thought it was kind of funny.
Yep. They managed to end the episode with, like, a really, I actually thought, a good scene where Ayla and Ahsoka are kind of, you know, standing up at the top, like, overlooking the village. And Ahsoka's like, you know, you're right. If I had just stayed with Anakin, like, we might not ever have found this village. We might not have found the healer. Like, I wouldn't have been any use just staying there. Like, you know, thank you for, you know, kind of making me recognize what it was that I needed to do. And it was specifically Henrik Gilroy, who was the writer for this episode, talked about it, that it was specifically, like, they wanted to make Ayla and Ahsoka have more of a, like, sibling relationship, like, more of, like, a casual, like, I'm not your master, I'm just, like, an older sister relationship than the usual, like, master Padawan thing they had going on. And and his actual reference was, I wanted it to be more like Anakin and Obi-Wan and less like, you know, Plo Koon and Ahsoka or Anakin and Ahsoka, even though I've always felt like Anakin and Ahsoka was, like, an older brother, older sister, or younger sister thing, is, like, how I've always looked at their relationship, less of, like, master Padawan. But this is more like two sisters who are closer together in age, who are a little bit more casual. Like, you know, an older brother is, like, super protective of a younger sister, whereas an older sister is going to be protective, but probably in, like, a different way. And that's kind of how I like got the vibe between the two of them.
Right. Right. And actually, you know, so there's kind of a featurette on the episode where Dave Filoni talks about how they, you know, wanted to present Ayla Secura's character, and how he sort of saw her as, like, a more streetwise Jedi master, somebody who's maybe a little bit more casual, who kind of takes things in a less formal way than many of the other Jedi masters. And he actually had originally wanted to give her, like, an American accent, right? He didn't want her to sound like some of the others, but
which is French. French is the accent that they give a lot of the Twi'leks.
Right. And that's intentionally done on George Lucas. He wants them all to kind of have a shared cultural accent that kind of helps to define their speech patterns and their voices as distinct from other species and other groups in the galaxy. So, you know, so that is, like, an intentional choice that's being made. But I thought it was kind of interesting. And I do think the sort of the more streetwise mindset comes through. Other bits of kind of trivia here toward the end, maybe things that we kind of forgot to call out. While Anakin is being treated on board the frigate with, like, the medical droid, and he's got the oxygen mask on, they're actually using a sort of a muted version of the Darth Vader breathing. which is really easy to miss because it's not emphasized or called out in any way. But if you go back and listen to it, it is there, and it is, you know, it's almost like unconscious that you pick up on it, I think. It felt like eerily familiar to me the first time I watched through, and then after I read the trivia, I was like, oh, that's why. We've also, I don't think there is any other major trivia that we haven't called out, actually.
No, it's just a bunch of Orabash text that's all over the place that says various things. Right. Yeah. No.
The screen, when they're about to crash into the star, the screen says impact in Orabash. It's pretty funny.
Yep.
But
it ended up being a pretty good episode. I mean, it's like two, like I said, it's like two distinct storylines. There's like the space battle, and then there's the crash landing and the discovery of the Lerman. I didn't have high hopes for this episode going in. I didn't really remember a ton, but I actually really liked Ayla Secura as a character in this. I think we're now 3 for 3 of them introducing other Jedi generals and me really enjoying them being in the episodes between Kit Fisto and Plo Koon. So I wouldn't say it was great, but I liked the episode. I liked the characterization. I thought the space battle was exciting. I thought a lot of the stuff they did when they landed was well-written and made sense. I enjoyed the messaging that Ayla was trying to give to Ahsoka about, hey, you have to understand, like, there's a difference between caring about people and becoming attached. And like, that's something you're going to have to learn. I like that lesson. An 8, I guess, for me sounds correct. Like, it seems like a pretty solid 8. I don't see how I could really grade it lower than that. It wasn't, you know, such a killer episode that I want to rewatch it all the time and I feel like it needs a 9 or something, but an 8 seems fair.
Yeah, I've kind of been debating what rating to give it. You know, like in the grander scheme of the entire series, like I would probably give it like a 7. But we've kind of been rating it sort of within like the season that it appears, and I think it's a season 1-8 for sure.
Yeah.
Like it's very solid. It was fun to watch. It was well written, cleanly structured. You know, good dialogue, good characterization. Like, I don't really have any criticism. It just wasn't as well written, as well animated, you know, as, you know, like engaging of a plot as we get later.
Yeah. Well, the thing that hurts it is they do a lot of the same stuff in other episodes better later on in the series, right? Like a similar storyline with similar sacrifices, with similar lessons and similar morals is done later in the series multiple times and done better, right? Like my thing that I ended up loving Clone Wars so much is because they lean into these like moral quandaries that the characters have to solve, and they do them in some pretty emotional ways later on. This episode's pretty light on the emotion. The moral is there, but the emotional weight behind it isn't as deep as it can be because Anakin is the character who's at risk, right? Like, we know Anakin is not going to die. So like, it doesn't really matter what decision Ahsoka makes. Like, he's going to be fine, but she still makes the right decision anyways. Later on in the series, some of these moral quandaries are faced with characters who may legitimately die or do die when things don't go correct. And I think that hits a lot harder than this, but they're experimenting with stuff, right? Like, this is a lot of times in season one, it's the first time they've ever done something. And so they're kind of taking baby steps as opposed to diving in head first. And I respect it, but yeah, like, I think that's what qualifies it as a season 1-8 instead of an overall 8.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that statement.
Kind of actually talked about this episode for a long time. I'm surprised we hit nearly 50 minutes just talking about the first episode.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had a little bit of setup where we kind of talked about some things that are also happened in the second episode. So,
yeah,
I think we may roll through Defenders of the Peace a little bit more quickly because we've kind of addressed a lot of the stuff. But I could be wrong. Well, let's see how it goes. So Defenders of the Peace picks up immediately where we left off, more or less. Anakin is recovering from his injuries, and as they are sort of spending some time in the Lerman village, Rex spots a Separatist dropship flying in through the atmosphere nearby. And that is, of course, never a good sign. So we've got some, you know, some accusation from Tiwak Ka, the leader of the Lerman, that, you know, they've brought their war to his planet and this is their fault. And, you know, they protest, of course, there's no way the separatists know that we're here. Like, nobody knows that we're here because we didn't intend to come here. And, you know, like, regardless, you know, like, we don't want to endanger you. So, you know, we'll hide and conceal ourselves so that they don't find us and we don't cause problems for you.
I appreciated that they were quick to call out that, like, it's not our fault the separatists were here. If the writers had chosen to make it the Jedi's fault the separatists were there, it almost makes it, like, too easy for T-Watt to be like, oh, well, this is y'all's fault. Like, this happened, blah, 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 blah. You know, and I appreciate that they didn't do that because it made it more of like, okay, well, now you really actually have to, you do have to make a choice, right? Like, it's not the Jedi's fault. You can't blame it on them. This is the separatists coming here of their own free will, which, you know, if the separatists were only there because the Jedi were there, then T-Watt can kind of be like, see, I told you so. Like, we never should have given them any help. But because they're not, then he kind of has to reevaluate his standpoint on things. He chooses not to, of course, because he's, you know, old and dogmatic and stuck in his ways and believes all that stuff. But the separatist commander, Locke Dird, is, I thought when I first watched this that it was someone doing a George Takei impression, but it is actually George Takei himself who's doing the voice for this. He was actually supposed to be a recurring character, but they ended up just, for whatever reason, not bringing him back. The only other time he's mentioned in canon is in Catalyst, which is a Rogue One prequel novel. And it's kind of a shame. I would have liked to have seen this character more. He was really, really great. He plays the, like, you know, evil, conniving separatist commander really, really well in this role. So
he does. Yeah. George Takei is a treasure, and none of us deserve him.
It was also the first major crossover of a Star Trek character onto Star Wars. They've had, like, supporting characters who've done it before, but this was the first time a major character crossed over. So.
Yeah, I only wish we would have gotten a recurring George Takei voice in here, but sadly it was not to be. But yeah, no, I do, just to kind of call back to the kind of the plot structure here. I love, in the first episode of this arc, we get Tiwak Ka challenging the Jedi philosophy and challenging their beliefs about the war, I think with some very valid questions. And then in the second episode, we get Tiwak Ka's philosophy being challenged. So even if we bought into what he was saying the first time, now suddenly as viewers, we're like, oh, man. Well, but, like, now the Jedi have a good point. Like, hey, the Separatists are here of their own volition. Like, how are you going to deal with that? Well, and I love that they're sort of very explicitly saying, like, this is a really complicated issue.
It's what Star Wars does so well, right? Like, it's easy to make things black and white where one side is all good and one side is all evil. It is a lot harder when there are shades of gray mixed in there. And I think what Star Wars does really well is they make one side evil and they make one side good, but they blend the two together in the middle very, very often to prevent you from being able to be like, oh, well, I'm just always this way, right? Like, what does, you know, Obi-Wan say? Only a Sith deals in absolutes, right? Which in itself is an ironic statement by saying that. But it's basically saying, like, you can't always just say, I side with this or I side with that. Like, both sides have some aspect of them that is correct because that's what makes, you know, that's why people are able to believe the things that they do. Like, yeah, the Jedi are wrong in that they are continuing to, you know, exacerbate this conflict. But at the same time, trying to be a pacifist forever and never standing up for yourself and never fighting isn't the way either, right? Like, there is a medium between the two. It is the exact same parallel as love and attachment, right? Like, cutting yourself entirely off from love to avoid attachment is not correct. Giving yourself entirely over to attachment is not correct. There's a middle ground there where both sides have merit, and that's the same thing as it is with this. So, you know, T-Watt kind of goes out to meet the separatists to buy some time for the Jedi to get out, and he's very adamant that the Jedi not be discovered in his village, because that would lead to the wrath of the separatists falling down upon them. And he thinks by getting the Jedi out of there, you know, the separatists will just come in and basically say, like, hey, we're in charge here, and then leave them alone. And he goes out to meet, you know, Locke Dirt, and Locke Dirt basically just like dismisses him, you know, outright. He's basically like, oh, I don't care about anything that you have to say. You know, I appreciate that you are, you know, bowing down to our control, but also it doesn't really help you. Like, we're just going to do whatever we want. And Locke Dirt pretty much has the droids ransack the village, even though the Lerman have not done anything to upset him. But they report back that, well, there's no signs of, you know, Republic contraband or prisoners or anything like that. So he's like, all right, well, we won't destroy your village this time then. But, you know, we reserve the right to come back and do further inspections at any time. And T'Wok kind of just, you know, kowtows to him and is like, yep, whatever. Just, you know, we're not going to fight you. And Locke Dirt's like, oh, you're smarter than you appear then.
Great. Yeah. A nice little backhanded insult there. Or backhanded compliment. Yeah, this is sort of exactly what I think Ahsoka, you know, this was like explicitly like her criticism of their belief that, like, if you don't stand up for yourself, then someone is going to come in and take advantage of you. And, you know, so we kind of get, you know, the Jedi and, you know, the clones have kind of retreated into the tall grass, and we see Wag 2, you know, he's got some issues with his father's kind of strict adherence to their pacifist philosophy and to their philosophy of kind of like non-resistance even. Because I think there's a difference between being non-violent and being non-resistant. And his father's philosophy is very much like we don't resist in any way. And so that's, I think, kind of becoming an issue where the younger generation they're very much like not sure that this is a good idea. So Wag 2 sends his friend Tub to kind of watch after the Jedi and Rex and Bly. And so we kind of catch up with them. They're hanging out in the grass, hiding, discussing, you know, kind of what to do next and then like what's going to happen to the Lerman. And we get right back into the action as a scout droid overhears them and discovers them. And fortunately, they spot it too, kind of almost at the same time. So it starts rushing off through the grass and they have to chase after it. Fortunately, Aayla Secura is able to get ahead of it and cut it in half and prevent it from reporting in.
There was a good, before the, what the scout droid overhears them talking about is a discussion about why won't the villagers fight back? Like, why are they content right to just roll over? And Rex, you know, thinks it's a lack of pride. Ahsoka basically calls them cowards. She's like, it's a lack of courage. And Aayla is like, no, that's not correct. Sometimes it takes courage to stick to one's own beliefs. And Anakin's like, well, it really doesn't matter one way or the other because the Separatists will be back and we need a ship. So let's steal one from the Separatists.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, I guess I kind of forgot to call out. I think it's at the very beginning of the episode or near the beginning. They're debating sort of what to do about the Separatists approaching, and Ahsoka wants to stand up to them and fight them. And, you know, of course, T'Wok Ka'a is like, absolutely not. Under no circumstances. And she's, Ahsoka's protesting pretty hard. Anakin's like, no, we're not going to force somebody to do something they don't want to do. You know, so he draws kind of a hard line there for Ahsoka and says, like, you can't make these people fight if they don't want to fight. Which I think is good because it does then set up, you know, sort of the moral distinction that he draws later in the episode. So I just wanted to call that out.
Well, the fortune cookie for this episode was when surrounded by war, one must eventually choose a side. And that is correct, right? Because at a certain point in time, not engaging is benefiting one side or the other anyways, right? So just by default, choosing to not engage still means you are choosing a side. And if you are not amenable to that being the side that you're on, then you have to understand that at a certain point in time, the only option may be to fight, right? And I think Ahsoka even points that out, but like, isn't, she says at one point in time, like, isn't liberty worth fighting for?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, not if it means we have to compromise our beliefs.
Well, yeah, I think, Yeah, I think he sort of questions, he says something like, you know, but is it worth killing for?
Right.
Yeah, you know, so yeah, it's very much, you know, sort of challenging. And I think the reason that these sort of like, these arguments ring through so strongly is that these are, you know, real human debates that happen on a regular basis in people's lives. You know, like, where is the line? What is worth dying for? What is worth killing for? You know, and what other options are there? You know, like, obviously there are many different ways to resist, you know, what you might feel is like an incorrect path, or to resist oppression. And, you know, I think there's a criticism here that like maybe fighting and violence is not always the right answer, but, you know, blind pacifism and non-resistance also doesn't solve the problem. And so I think the great thing here is that neither side really has like an all-encompassing solution to a problem that in real life also does not have an all-encompassing solution.
Yeah, they don't take the path of telling you which is right. They just present both sides, and then it's kind of left up to the viewer to make a conclusion, you know, to draw a conclusion on their own or to think about it, right? And I like that, because oftentimes when a show picks a side openly, it can come off as like preachy or saying the other side is wrong or something like that. So what this side does well is it presents both viewpoints and a middle point, and is like, all right, well, now you guys get to choose which one of the ones that you believe was correct, right? So, like you said, they kill the little spy droid. They wonder where it was going. They decide they could climb up one of the big trees to kind of see what base it was going to. And they realize that there's a heavily guarded separatist base that has been set up kind of around the ship that landed. And Anakin is really in no position to assault the base, you know, openly by himself like he normally would if he right. was in peak Anakin condition. So Rex and Bly decide that they're going to go scout up. And we swap back to the view of the Separatist, and Locke is announcing his new weapon called the Defoliator, which is capable of destroying, well, he brags it's capable of destroying organic life while leaving non-organics unharmed. They ask for volunteers from the droids to go be the non-organics that will not be harmed during the test firing. And two right. slow B1 battle droids kind of get left out in the cold by all the rest of their brethren, and they get volunteered by Locke Dird.
It's so funny to watch this happen, because this is the kind of thing I feel like I've seen this a number of times and actually like once in a while done this in real life, right? Where they're like, ask for volunteers, and you just sort of like step back, right? And that's kind of what happens. Like, the entire droid corps steps back immediately when he asks for volunteers, except for two of them. And they kind of repeatedly step back further and further away as he's talking. It's great. You know, once again, the droids bringing in the comic relief at a key moment. So the two, you know, head out, and the weapon is test fired, and it works. It works exactly, you know, sort of as intended. It destroys the local vegetation, you know, burns up all the grass, but leaves the droids intact. And Locke is like, yeah, it works. It's a huge success. And he's reporting to Count Dooku via hologram. But Dooku's like, I mean, it's one thing to you know, destroy all these plants, but we need to know if it's going to work against living targets, right? If it's not going to take out clone troopers, then all the money that we've given you to develop this weapon has been wasted, basically, is what he's saying. And so I don't remember if Dooku explicitly suggests using the local people, the Lerman, or if that's Locke Dird's idea.
That's Locke Dird. Locke Dird's like, I picked this planet specifically because it has a population on it.
Right. It's right. Pretty evil. Yeah. So explicitly evil.
Yeah. Here's the other end of the spectrum where it's like, this person is evil. No gray matter about it. Like, they're yeah. just bad. So Anakin correctly, you know, predicts like, well, I've seen what this weapon could do. I would be surprised if they don't immediately turn around and use it on the Lerman. That probably is the reason why they're here, which he's correct about. So he's like, look, we have to take out the communications station, steal the shuttle, and then we have to return to help the Lerman. And Ahsoka's like, well, T'Wat doesn't want our help. And this is where Anakin says the line you mentioned earlier, but he's like, there's a difference between pulling innocents into a war and leaving them to extinction, which is correct, right? And that's definitely where he draws that line. It's like, look, we're not going to force them to fight if they don't want to, but we're also not going to let them be just completely wiped out. Like, that is not the Jedi way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, again, I appreciate, you know, we do get the insight into, you know, kind of the deeply held moral convictions that guide Anakin's decisions and ultimately, of course, lead to his downfall. But we also get, you know, like you kind of talked about, we get some insight into Ahsoka's development here and the lessons that she is learning from Anakin during the war. And, you know, lessons that will, you know, go on to guide her future adventures. You know, and I think we see this sort of this ethic right here that he explicitly states repeated throughout her story later on, where she won't necessarily like make other people do things, but she also is always there to stand between other people and somebody who wants to do them harm.
Yeah, we get so they do manage to breach the station. They kill a bunch of droids in as many sneaky ways as they possibly can. Even breaking some droid necks, which I thought was funny because it's like they're droids, but that's still a valid way to destroy them, I guess. They cut down a bunch of them. They take out the droids in the command center. They steal a shuttle. And luckily for them, they find a couple shield generators that are there as well. So they steal the two portable shield generators and they return to the Lerman village. And they kind of inform, they're like, look, the Separatists are coming. You guys are going to get attacked. It doesn't matter that you weren't sheltering or sided with the Republic. The Separatists don't care. They're going to destroy you. And T'Wat Ka's like, fine, if holding on to our beliefs means that our people die, then so be it. Like, we won't give these up. And WAG-2 is like, I'm not down with that. Like, I don't want to die. We should defend ourselves. And so they at least, you know, WAT-2 and some of the others help to set up the giant pods in like a barricade around the village. And they set up the shield generators, despite T'Wat literally protesting, even defending themselves. He's literally like, nope, if we're going to be wiped out, we're going to be wiped out. And that's a pretty, you know, that's the stubborn dogmatic behavior that I think gets criticized, is like, you are so stuck in your beliefs that you can't see that. And WAG-2, you know, he calls it out. He's like, defending ourselves doesn't necessarily mean fighting or killing. Like, we can defend ourselves, and when the battle happens, they actually manage to do that, much the same way that they defend themselves against the, you know, the Mastiff earlier, right? So they set up the shield generators. Lock Durd, that name is a very silly name. Lock Durd fires the defoliator around at the village, but the shield protects it, luckily. So Lock instead sends his battle droids forward. The Jedi and clones, you know, engage in a pitched battle to defend the village, despite T'Wat still complaining about it.
Yeah. I think it's actually a really great, like, set piece scene when the defoliator cannon, like, explodes and the, you know, they're kind of inside the shield watching as the flames kind of surround them. And I think it's a moment when a lot of the Lerman sort of see the incredibly serious and dire nature of their circumstances. And it's sort of like, puts them in a position where even T'Wat Ka can't really, he's rendered silent for that scene. You know, it's like, oh man, like it's one thing to say I'm willing to die for my beliefs. It's an entirely other thing
to actually face
confronted
death.
With the actual like brutal death that waits for you. And it does make you question, I think. And I think even T'Wat Ka maybe had a moment there where it was just like, is this the decision that I want to make?
Right. And so Lock Durd sends his second and third wave of droids forward. They manage to breach the shield and unfortunately destroy the shield generators. So he's ready to load another defoliator round, but Anakin has pushed up. Anakin's now, you know, back to his normal Anakin-y self. He's feeling great. He pushes up and pretty much single-handedly destroys the tanks and the defoliator cannon. And captures Lock Durd himself and floats up in the air. And he actually even does like the George Takei, like the very sad side. He's like, oh no, like when he gets caught, and he's trying to run away and he's just floating in the air and Anakin's holding him up in the air. And he was literally like, oh no, my promotion. And I was like, this is great. This character's fantastic. I really wish they would have brought him back for more stuff. But WAG-2 decides, you know, like, I'm going to defend you know, I'm going to defend my people. And they use the rope to trip all the droids over so that Ahsoka can easily decapitate them, showing that you can defend yourself without necessarily fighting or killing on your own, thus living up to what he had said to his father earlier, like, we should not just lay down and allow ourselves to die. We should defend ourselves, even if it means that we don't kill and, you know, we don't fight. We can still do things like trip droids and allow them to be decapitated.
I do have to acknowledge, of course, though, that, you know, Tiwak Ka is extremely progressive for the Star Wars galaxy and his view that fighting droids would count as killing, because I think the vast majority of characters that we encounter would not consider destroying droids to be the same as killing.
Yeah. So they end up winning. All the droids are destroyed. Locke Durd is captured. Anakin and the others prepare to leave, and they thank Wagtu and Tiwat Ka. But Tiwat is like, I still wonder at what cost. And there's a fantastic scene where it pans backwards and the three Republic cruisers, the Resolute and two others, like appear in the sky overhead. And all the characters are like looking up, and it was beautiful. Like the clouds are like, look like they're like a watercolor painting. Like every once in a while, I find a screenshot of like a Star Wars episode that I want to like make my background for my laptop. And like, that was one of those screenshots where I was like, damn, that's a beautiful, beautiful shot right there.
Yeah.
And so I love that, but you know, he's correct. At what cost? Like at this point, they have basically chosen a side. Like they stood up to the separatist to protect themselves. But standing up to the separatists to protect yourselves means that you are not on the side of the separatists, because they don't view it that way. Like the separatists view you as disposable and something to be experimented on. And if you don't think you are that thing, then you're on the side of the Republic.
Yeah. You know, the fortune cookie was very literal for this episode. You know, and I can't blame Tiwak Ka for asking the question. Well, even though, of course, I personally disagree with his version of nonviolence.
Yeah, extreme nonviolence, which just begets more violence, right?
Well, yeah, it permits evil to persist unopposed, right? And I think that's kind of the moral issue that you run into. But anyways, that brings us to the end of Defenders of the Peace. And, you know, again, I think this is a super fun episode. I appreciate that they take the time to ask the moral questions and to give us kind of the characters' perspectives and to give us various answers to kind of those questions of like, what is permissible? What is the right thing to do in the face of, you know, a violent, oppressive force? And, you know, what is the right thing to do when you see...
I said the concept art of that final scene with the Resolute and the other two Venators above the village with, like, the sun setting and everything.
It's a pretty fantastic background, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it does a great job, I think, of asking those questions and then letting various characters share their thoughts without ever stating who's correct. Right. And honestly, kind of with Tiwak Ka as the mouthpiece at the very end there, explicitly leaving the question open, you know, like, all right, well, we took a side, but what's it going to cost us in the end? And that is, you know, the whole question of the Clone Wars, right? Everyone takes a side. And then everyone pays the price for the side that they took.
Right.
And nobody gets out, you know, unscathed, basically. Except for Sidious.
And even then, only for a period of time.
Yeah, yeah. Literally only him. And then, you know, only until things revert to the mean, if you will. So, mm-hmm. I don't have any explicit criticisms here. Also, just to note, like, there's not really any significant trivia to call out for this episode. You know, there are kind of a couple of, you know, like, minor goofs with various shots with, like, things being changed that aren't really worth mentioning. And that's more or less it. Like, there's no significant callbacks, call outs to make. But I'm kind of inclined to just say this is another season 1-8.
Yep.
This is overall a great set of episodes for season one, for the early, you know, the early episodes, the early storylines. It's a lot of fun to watch. It's a good one, I think, to watch with kids. And yeah, don't really have anything else to add.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's definitely a season 1-8. It's pretty impressive that both episodes were like were equal in terms of how much I enjoyed them and how good I think they were. Honestly, I would not have guessed that these would be 2-8s before watching it. For right? some reason, I did not remember them that fondly, but I ended up actually really enjoying them. So yeah, I kind of recommend these episodes. If you haven't watched them in a while, I think you'll come away pretty pleased with them. It's good. It's good Star Wars. It's just good Star Wars. That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. No, agreed. I definitely was sort of expecting at least one of these to be like a 6. And here we are. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I think that's it for this week then.
Okay. Well, be sure to join us in the next episode when we will be discussing, I think we're just doing Trespass, right? We're just going to do a single episode.
I think that is the plan. It'll be a fast episode. We'll do Trespass. Trespass is kind of a standalone. And then we'll come back the following episode with Blue Shadow Virus and Mystery of a Thousand Moons. So if you are following along by episodes, Trespass is episode 15 of season one. And Blue Shadow Virus and Mystery of a Thousand Moons are 17 and 18. That is, of course, because we did 16, which is Hidden Enemy, back in the very first episode. So
that's right. All right. Well, I am looking forward to that. I do remember that episode very fondly.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah. All right. Well, until next time, may the force be with you.
And also with you.